From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, more with Susan Orlean, author of the bestseller The Orchid Thief, which was made into the film adaptation. In 1994, she wrote a New Yorker profile of children's clown David Friedman. Only after publication did she learn the dark side of his family history, which is now told in the new documentary Capturing the Friedmans. Also, British writer Mark Haddon, the narrator of his novel, is a 15-year-old boy who was autistic. In a New York Times book review, Jay McInerney described the boy as certainly one of the strangest and most convincing characters in recent fiction. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews St. Louis Shoes, the new CD by composer and saxophonist Greg Osby. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Attacks against U.S. troops continued in Iraq today. Military officials say two soldiers were killed, one by hostile fire southwest of Baghdad, the second in a bombing on the Baghdad Airport Road. The BBC's Richard Galpin is in Baghdad. He says there are also reports there's been another oil pipeline explosion.
There are reports of yet another attack on an Iraqi oil pipeline, which has led to quite serious damage to the pipeline. And this is the fifth or sixth such attack over the past week or so. And already it's had a pretty devastating impact in terms of the electricity supply here to the capital, Baghdad. There's not been any proper electricity, mains electricity now, for a number of days, and that is partly because of these what appear to be deliberate sabotage attempts on the pipelines across the country.
The BBC's Richard Galpin in Baghdad. The Supreme Court today struck down a Texas law that bans sodomy, saying the state cannot make private sexual conduct a crime. The 6-3 ruling also invalidates similar laws in a dozen other states. There's been a mixed reaction from members of Congress. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Republican Senator Trent Lott's home state of Mississippi is one of the 13 states whose anti-sodomy laws were struck down, and he's not happy about it.
I think this is a very negative development, and I think now it's just opened up almost anything in the name of so-called privacy.
But Massachusetts House Democrat Barney Frank, who's openly gay, hailed the Supreme Court decision invalidating laws against gay sex. Frank draws two conclusions from the ruling.
First of all, we have a great declaration on behalf of personal freedom by six justices. Secondly, if George Bush gets reelected and two of those justices, Stevens and O'Connor, leave over the next 6 years, as is probable, George Bush can get this reversed.
House GOP Majority Leader Tom DeLay declined to comment on the ruling. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
A Texas jury today convicted a woman of murdering a homeless man by hitting him with her car, driving him home, and allowing him to die while he was lodged in the car's windshield. The jury deliberated less than an hour before reaching a verdict. A sentencing hearing is now underway. Shante Jawan Mallard testified she was confused.
I was asking God to tell me what to do. I didn't know what to do.
Okay.
And I was just scared. And I was crying.
Mallard said she was returning home after a night of drinking and taking ecstasy. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 67 points to 90.79 in active trading. The Nasdaq closed up 31 points to 16.34, and the S&P 500 closed up 10 points to 9.85. This is NPR News. Microsoft won a victory in a federal appeals court in Richmond today. A three-judge panel overturned an order that would have forced Microsoft to include Java software in its Windows operating system. The makers of Java, Sun Microsystems, had sued Microsoft, claiming anti-competitive practices, and asked that Microsoft be forced to include Java while that suit is being litigated. A bill to reauthorize federal spending for special education has cleared one more hurdle in Congress. NPR's Claudia Sanchez reports.
Despite lingering disputes over money, the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions has voted unanimously to reauthorize the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Schools will be allowed to suspend disabled students if they're disruptive, and parents will now have 20 days instead of 45 to appeal a suspension. But if school officials decide to permanently ban a student from a regular classroom, they must prove the student's violation of school rules is not related to his disability. The exception would be taking a gun or drugs to school. A House version of the bill does not protect children from being expelled regardless of their disability. Both House and Senate bills, which affect 6.5 million students, will cut paperwork, require earlier screening of children, and help disabled teenagers make the transition after they graduate from high school. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News, Washington.
Officials in New Mexico say firefighters were able today to contain a wildfire that has burned about 800 acres along the Rio Grande. The fire began last night about 5 miles northwest of downtown Albuquerque. Dozens of homes were evacuated. Some residents are now being allowed back in their homes. Authorities suspect that the blaze was deliberately set. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop features the Geographic Century, a CD from NPR's Radio Expeditions on great moments of exploration in the 20th century at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Earlier this week, we spoke with Andrew Jarecki, the director of the new documentary Capturing the Friedmans. He'd set out to make a movie about David Friedman, a children's birthday party clown in New York City. But Friedman was evasive about his own family history, which led Jarecki to wonder what the family story really was. Here's a clip from early in the filmmaking process of Friedman telling Jarecki about his father.
He died of a surprise heart attack about 5 years ago. And it was very, very sad. He was, selfless and altruistic.
But in the end, he wasn't together with your mom.
He wasn't together with my mom at the end.
And when did they make the decision not to be together? Long before he died?
A couple of years before his death. There's some things I don't want to talk about.
Eventually, Jarecki discovered the family stories David Friedman was reluctant to tell. David's father, Arnold, collected child pornography. When he was arrested for getting some through the mail, it unleashed a much wider investigation. In the end, Arnold and his youngest son, Jesse, were accused of sexually molesting students in the computer classes that Arnold taught at home. Arnold and Jesse maintained their innocence, but fearing they'd be convicted, they pleaded guilty in the hopes of getting lighter sentences. Capturing the Friedmans raises questions about faulty memory, problems within the legal system, and the elusive nature of truth. It also gets to an issue that I often worry about as an interviewer. Someone who comes off as very sensitive or very amusing in an interview may have a much darker side that I remain totally unaware of. I worry that my interview may therefore be somewhat misleading. This is something Susan Orlean faced after she wrote a New Yorker profile of David Friedman back in 1994, which focused on his work as a clown and did not mention his family history. Orlean is known for her best-selling book, The Orchid Thief, which was the basis of the film adaptation. We invited her to talk with us about how she reacted when she learned the story of the Friedman family. Your profile of David Friedman ran in 1994, 7 years after Arnold Friedman was arrested on sexual abuse charges. Did you have any clues about the Friedman family when you wrote the piece?
When I worked on the profile, I had asked David a little bit about his family. I was curious about how his parents felt about his choice of professions being a clown. And he was very evasive. He just sort of shunted the questions off, and I decided that it was just a matter of him not choosing to talk that much about his family, and I really didn't pursue it more. My interest in the profile was very much in the here and now. It was, what's the life of a clown like? It seemed like an extraordinary life. Less about the psychological implications of being a clown or his family life. When I finished the piece, I got a letter. The piece was already done. It was already in print. It didn't happen to be on the newsstand yet. I got a letter from someone saying, did you know that David Friedman's father is a pederast? it was kind of a shocking thing to receive, and it was also too late to do anything about it and too late to add it into the piece. And I thought, well, what if I'd gotten that letter a week earlier? Would I have dealt with that? It was hard. It's hard to know. I mean, certainly when I think all of us in the back of our minds have this mythic notion that children's clowns are a little weird, that maybe all of them have some sort of unnatural interest in children. So I at first thought this is just one of these rumors. This is a myth. Somebody, maybe it's even a rival. I mean, it's a very competitive world. But it haunted me. And when I heard about the film, it really hit me.
I'm sure that your New Yorker profile of David Friedman encouraged a lot of parents to try to book David Friedman for their children's parties because, hey, he's the guy who was written up in the New Yorker. He must be good. Now, a lot of these same parents would probably have had second thoughts, rightly or wrongly, if they had known that David's brother and his father were accused and then pled guilty to sexual abuse charges, even though outside of the courtroom they maintained their innocence. Do you wonder about the impact of your story on his life and on, you know, what parents are thinking now who hired him as a result of your article?
Definitely thinking about it. It's the nature of making public someone's life is so complex, and it's so fraught with responsibility. And in this case, first of all, I think it's you have to separate the fact of David from his father and his brother. David is a separate person. There was never any implication in anything that he had anything inappropriate to do with these kids. But if I were a parent and I heard that the clown I was going to hire had a family history like that, I probably wouldn't hire him. There's so much that comes with writing about people or exposing people to the public eye. When I was doing a profile years ago of someone who was in a religious position of, you know, of stature in his community, and he grew to feel very comfortable with me, and then one day he said to me, "Do you want to come meet my mistress?" And I thought, well, now I really don't know what to do. Part of me was thinking, well, this is great for my story. I mean, here this guy is standing in his community as somebody who's of some position in a religious, fairly conservative community, and he's introducing me to his mistress. You know, this was overwhelming. I didn't know what to do. Did I want to have his wife read in the New Yorker story about him that he was having an affair? I didn't know if I really felt that I could put myself in that position morally. I mean, no matter what, as a writer, you still have to be a moral person and make decisions. It would have been good for the story. It would have added an element that would have been really interesting. I couldn't do it. If I had heard that David Friedman's father was a pedophile, you know, to return to that, what would I have done?
What would you have done? Do you think you would have written the story?
Yes. I would have written the story, and I would have folded it in with a great deal of delicacy, because I don't think it's fair to imply that it's very much in the American tradition that you don't hold someone responsible for acts committed by members of their family. I don't know. I guess this is the great question in being a writer and your moral obligations to your subjects and the fundamental inability to ever know the truth and your need to kind of acknowledge that in your writing.
Are there any parts of your piece on David Friedman that read differently to you now? Now that you know more about the Friedman family, and here's the part I'm thinking of. You have a part in which you say about Friedman, he also started doing performances at parties for adults under the name David Friedman. as opposed to under the name Silly Billy, his clown name. For adult parties, he does magic, and he's developed expertise in the field of off-color balloons. He has mastered a balloon man with a rising and falling erection, and he believes he will soon have a breakthrough involving ejaculation.
The minute I heard about this movie, that part of the piece flashed through my eyes. It was something that when he showed it to me, I thought it was kind of crude. It's not the sort of humor that I find appealing. Now it's chilling.
Have you spoken to David Friedman recently, like since the release of the movie Capturing the Friedmans?
I've had a lot of email exchanges with him, and I hadn't heard from him in a number of years. I don't keep in touch with people generally after I've written about them. He got in touch with me about several months ago. He really wanted me to see the movie. He really supported the movie, and it mattered to him that I saw it, which is interesting, given that we're not friends, we haven't stayed in touch. And he said he wanted to sit and talk with me about it, and we haven't managed to do that yet. But it seems interesting. I don't feel that he lied to me. I asked him a little bit about his family. He dodged, not in an unusual way, simply deflected the question. He never lied to me. Had he lied to me, I would be angry, and I would feel that I'd been manipulated. In this case, he simply avoided a painful subject, and it's interesting to me that he wants to talk to me now and maybe explain a little more what was going through his mind when I was working on the profile of him.
But that's the thing. If you've written a portrait of someone and then you find out something about their past that leads you to an understanding of them and their work that you didn't have before, particularly if it's something dark about their family, do you feel betrayed that they didn't volunteer this information? Or do you feel like, well, who would volunteer that information? And they have a right to their life and to their work without this really disturbing part of their family life, this really upsetting part of their family life, kind of penetrating every action that they make.
It's a two-edged situation. I guess to begin with, I present myself as a writer as fallible, as subjective, not as an omniscient observer of the people I'm writing about. And part of that is because I've come to believe and understand that it is impossible to know someone thoroughly. And we don't even know ourselves thoroughly. How could we possibly know someone that we spend a limited amount of time with? It's absurd. And I think some of the artificiality and inauthenticity of modern celebrity journalism is all about that, in my opinion. It's spending an hour in a press situation and then writing a piece with the authority and the voice of someone pretending to know somebody well. It's not possible. It's absurd. I hope that my perceptions and my sensitivity to someone's character will lead me to an ultimate truth about them, even if it's not a specific truth. David Friedman struck me as somebody who had a kind of deep, sort of tragic kind of quality, and maybe that's just the nature of clowns. So did I get the specifics right? No, but I don't think I got the truth about him wrong, the fundamental reality of his nature. Do I blame him for not telling me this? Absolutely not. I mean, people, as it is, I consider it kind of a remarkable that anyone is ever willing to talk to a writer. So to begin with, it's something that it's a privilege if someone lets you into their life. I don't want to be lied to, but people lie all the time. Do I feel someone needs to volunteer something this tragic? No, it's not realistic to think that they would.
My guest is Susan Orlean. She's best known as the author of The Orchid Thief. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ My guest is Susan Orlean. We've been talking about her 1994 New Yorker profile of David Friedman, which she wrote before learning about his family's story, the story now told in the documentary Capturing the Friedmans. Orlean is the author of the nonfiction bestseller The Orchid Thief, the story of John LaRoche, his obsession with rare orchids, and his shadowy past. The book is the basis of the film adaptation, which featured Meryl Streep in the role of Susan Orlean. You spent about 2 weeks writing your profile of David Friedman and about 2 years writing about John LaRoche, the subject of your book, The Orchid Thief. You found out all kinds of things about John LaRoche, about his life, his divorce, his car accident, I mean, just, and his crimes. Was it difficult for you to figure out what to reveal, what to keep secret, and what was even true?
It was very hard to figure out what was true. John, in a way, was the ultimate modern subject. He was an unreliable narrator. In fact, that was part of what the book became about to me, was about the myths that he developed about himself. And there was a point in the book when I simply said, there were so many things he said to me that seemed incredible, seemed impossible. But what mattered wasn't that they, to find out whether or not they were true, but that he was a person who had a need to create a sort of fantasy ego, alter ego for himself. There was a point where he said to me that he had found the oldest fossil pearl that's ever been found. And I thought, well, that just seems hard to believe. But what was important was this was John's character, a need to make himself more important than he was.
Your book, The Orchid Thief, was a bestseller, and that was made into the movie adaptation, which was a very popular film. What impact do you think all of this has had on John LaRoche's life? Are you still in touch with him?
I hadn't been in touch with him for a while, and then I saw him when the movie was first being screened, and he came up to see the film for the first time. I think it was a very unnerving experience for him, even though he was such an egomaniac and loved attention. Seeing himself portrayed in a movie was sort of one step beyond what I think he was prepared for, and he was a little shocked. And then John being John, he started to really enjoy it. He's turned his life around a lot. He's got a very nice woman he's involved with. They have a baby. He's leading the life of almost a yuppie, which is hard to believe given who he was.
Do you think that you proceed any differently now when you're profiling somebody? Now that you've had the experience of The Orchid Thief becoming a bestseller and a film, and now that you've had the experience of profiling the children's clown David Friedman and then finding out after the fact about his family and how his father and brother were both accused of sexually abusing children.
No matter what, I think when I'm profiling someone, I simply have to remind myself constantly of the really enormous moral challenge that it is. The unending fallibility of the process of reporting it's always present in my mind. And I think actually it's very useful to remain humble and be aware of how little you can count on knowing everything and what that means. And it means to emphasize, as I feel like I need to do, that this is a subjective portrait. It's a portrait. It's not a hologram. It's a sketch of someone, and it's someone processed through my perception of them. And I think that I can strive to having it be true, and I know that there will always be things that I'm going to miss. It's just impossible for that not to be the case. So it's a balance. It's a balance between hoping that the facts are right and acknowledging the limits to what, as a writer, I can know about my subjects.
Now, we've talked a little bit about how your writing has affected the lives of your subjects. because of the movie adaptation in which you were depicted as a character, your life, I'm sure, was changed a lot by the movie. How has your life been changed, and what has that taught to you about the effect of being the subject of a movie or a profile?
It's changed my life quite a bit, which I guess I was sort of prepared for, though I didn't know what it would feel like. It's made me more self-conscious in certain ways. I mean, I've enjoyed it. It's been fascinating. It's a bizarre kind of adventure ride. It has made me self-conscious. I feel more observed. And then, it really, in a way, to circle back to what we've been talking about, there's a great deal in the movie that's clearly not true. It's the fantasy of the screenwriter struggling with how to end his movie. So suddenly there's this image of me being presented to the world that goes off in this wild direction of me becoming a drug addict and having sex with my subject and trying to kill the screenwriter. And there are certain people who think this is true, and people who've seen the movie who didn't quite get the turn in the script.
Exactly.
Who look at me and say, "Are you still involved with LaRoche?" And I think, "Oh my God, what have I done?" It makes you appreciate the very, very quicksilver nature of truth and reality, and it makes me, well, I'm glad if it makes people a little bit afraid of me.
Why?
Well, it's, you know, instead of being just a normal writer, I'm a writer who pulled a gun on a screenwriter. It's kind of an impressive thing, but it does make you step back a little and think, well, what is reality? I mean, this was Charlie Kaufman's effort to make an honest adaptation of my book. And in order to do that, he had to completely change the facts. So it kind of addresses this issue again, which is truth is very mutable, and no one really can claim to have an absolute hold on it. In this case, my character completely transformed. It's not me at all, and yet that's me as being perceived by people who go to see the movie. So it's been kind of philosophically interesting, and it's made me appreciate my role as the intermediary between the experiences I have and the readers who read my work.
Susan Orlean, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Susan Orlean is the author of The Orchid Thief and writes profiles for The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Easter Island, a novel about two women living 60 years apart by Jennifer Vanderbees. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews St. Louis Shoes, the new CD by composer and saxophonist Greg Osby. We're listening to it now. And we meet British writer Mark Haddon. The narrator of his new novel, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, is a 15-year-old boy who is autistic. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. British writer Mark Haddon is the author of the new novel, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. It's told from the point of view of a 15-year-old boy named Christopher, who is a high-functioning autistic. Critic Michiko Kakutani writes, Mr. Haddon writes with such sympathy, such understanding of Christopher's interior life, that he makes all his obsessions and needs into a mirror of our own cravings for safety and order. This is Mark Haddon's first novel. He's written and illustrated several children's books. When his novel begins, Christopher finds his neighbor's dog lying dead, speared by a pitchfork. Christopher wants to find out who did it. The greater mysteries he is faced with have to do with comprehending his parents and the confusing, threatening world around him. Here's a reading from early in the story.
I pulled the fork out of the dog and lifted him into my arms and hugged him. He was leaking blood from the fork holes. I like dogs. You always know what a dog is thinking. It has four moods: happy, sad, cross, and concentrating. Also, dogs are faithful and they do not tell lies because they cannot talk. I had been hugging the dog for 4 minutes when I heard screaming. I looked up and saw Mrs. Shears running towards me from the patio. She was wearing pajamas and a house coat. Her toenails were painted bright pink and she had no shoes on. She was shouting, "What in God's name have you done to my dog?" I do not like people shouting at me. It makes me scared that they are going to hit me or touch me, and I do not know what is going to happen. "Let go of the dog," she shouted. "Let go of the damn dog, for Christ's sake." I put the dog down on the lawn and moved back 2 meters. She bent down. I thought she was going to pick the dog up herself, but she didn't. Perhaps she noticed how much blood there was and didn't want to get dirty. Instead, she started screaming again. I put my hands over my ears and closed my eyes and rolled forward till I was hunched up with my forehead pressed onto the grass. The grass was wet and cold. It was nice.
That's Mark Haddon reading from his new book, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Mark, what is your main character's behavioral or cognitive problem?
If he were diagnosed, he would be diagnosed as having Asperger's syndrome, which is a form of autism. I suppose you call it high-function autism, in that he can function on, you know, a day-to-day basis in a kind of rudimentary way. But he has a serious difficulty with life in that he really doesn't empathize with other human beings. He can't read their faces. He can't put himself in their shoes. And he can't understand anything more than the literal meaning of whatever said to him. Although I'm very careful in the book not to actually use the word Asperger's or autism.
Why not?
Because I don't want him to be labelled. And because I, as with most people who have a disability, I don't think it's necessarily the most important thing about him. He's obsessed with mathematics. That's one of the little hobbies he has. It's one of the ways he manages to pattern and organize his daily life and keep chaos at bay. And as a good friend of mine said after reading the book, a friend who is himself a mathematician, it's not a novel about a boy who has Asperger's syndrome. It's a novel about a young mathematician who has some strange behavioral problems. And I think that's right.
Because he sees the world in a very literal way and hears conversation in a very literal way, he doesn't understand jokes, he doesn't get irony, he doesn't understand human emotions, he has no real empathy for other people. What are the things that really scare him because they're so incomprehensible?
Because he can't put himself in other people's shoes, he doesn't really understand what other people are going to do. And other people are therefore extremely unpredictable. He likes his life to be safe and ordered. He's never gone farther than the end of his own road without someone to keep him company. So his life is very small and circumscribed. And it's things that threaten to wreck that pattern. It's change and difference and chaos which really terrify him.
He hates being touched. He can become violent when
indeed,
he's touched.
He does indeed, yeah.
Is that pretty typical of somebody with autism or with Asperger's syndrome?
I think it's fairly common, although a lot of people said to me, he seemed like a very real character. Did you do a lot of research? And I have to say, honestly, that I did more research about the London Underground and the inside of Swindon Railway Station, where some of the novel takes place, than I did about Asperger's syndrome. I gave him kind of 9 or 10 rules that he would live his life by. And then I didn't read any more about Asperger's, because I think There is no typical person who has Asperger's syndrome, and they're as large and diverse a group of people as any other group in society. And the important thing is that I did a lot of imagining, that I did a lot of putting myself into his shoes and trying to make him come alive as a human being, rather than getting him right, whatever that might mean.
Now, that's an interesting exercise for you, because what you're doing is putting yourself through the exercise of having empathy for a boy because of his problems, can't empathize with other people.
That's true, and I realized very shortly after I started writing the book, that the whole thing was littered with, you know, paradoxes. On the surface, it's a very, very simple book, partly because his voice is a very, very, very simple voice. And yet you're right, it needs a lot of empathy to write a character who has no empathy. Another paradox is that he says he can't tell lies. He needs to tell the truth all the time, and he always tries to do this. And yet, somehow, he always gets things wrong. We read the novel over his shoulder, saying, "You've got this wrong, you've got that wrong," and we can see more than him. He's a very unreliable narrator. And perhaps for me, the biggest paradox of all is that you'd think someone like Christopher, who can't empathise, who can't understand anything more than literal meaning, who can't see the bigger picture, would be a really bad narrator for a novel. And yet, it's a wonderful, wonderful voice to write a novel in, because it helps you avoid the pitfalls that so many novels fall into. He never explains anything. He never tries to make up the reader's mind one way or the other about anything, because he has no real idea of there being a reader out there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Haddon. His new novel is called The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Now, your main character, who is autistic, doesn't read novels. Although he's the narrator in your novel, he has a great deal of difficulty comprehending fiction. And there's a short excerpt I'd like you to read about that.
Mostly I read books about science and maths. I do not like proper novels. In proper novels, people say things like, "I am veined with iron, with silver, and with streaks of common mud. I cannot contract into the firm fist which those clench who do not depend on stimulus." I found this in a book in the library in town when Mother took me into town once. What does this mean? I do not know.
Where does this quote come from? Is this something that you made up to sound as obtuse as he finds metaphors as being?
Funnily enough, it's actually a quote from Virginia Woolf. It was Virginia Woolf on an off day in the middle, I think, of The Waves, an author whom I love, actually, but who sometimes got a little too carried away.
Wow, that's really terrible. That's totally incomprehensible and terrible. But that's your idea of how all fiction reads to him.
Yes, certainly.
One of the things you had to imagine is what it would be like for Christopher to, for the first time, get on a subway by himself and go to London, where he's never been, to find his mother. So he's coming from like a suburb of London to London. Mm-hmm. And it's like the Odyssey for him. So maybe you could just describe how you imagine, for instance, the subway, you know, the train looking from his point of view.
As we all know, when we visit a strange city, particularly in a foreign country, you're bombarded with information and noise and sights and sounds in these places. And for someone like Christopher, who sees everything around him and attempts to understand it all, it's completely overwhelming. Although I have to say that, strange as Christopher is, this experience isn't so alien. I think one of the reasons when we read about it that we understand it is because it's an extreme version of something we've all experienced at some time or other in our lives.
What did you most empathize with about Christopher and his confusion?
Of all the parts of Christopher that I empathise with, I have to say it's not the confusion that I empathise with most, it's the mathematics. I don't know whether we've said yet, but the book is peppered with little maths questions and maths puzzles and diagrams, because he is very good at maths and obsessed with maths, and he uses it as a way of blocking out the world sometimes, in the way that many of us use crosswords or other kinds of puzzles. And that's pretty much like myself. I very nearly did mathematics at university. And even now, after I've had a month or two of novel writing, I get a yearning for numbers again and go back to working on maths for a week or so. So all the maths in the book came straight out of my head. And that is the part of Christopher that is unadulteratedly me.
That's funny, because I thought you were going to say that you often felt so confused by the world and by people's emotions and their response to you in the same way, or in a different way, than he does. But that's not it, huh?
No, I really love interacting with other people, and in that sense, I'm very, very different from Christopher. But this is one of the ironies about Christopher. If we talk about Christopher as a whole, everyone talks about Asperger's syndrome and autism and talks about him as a kid with a disability. And yet every single little oddity of his behaviour I have taken from someone that I know who doesn't have that label, who is not called a disabled person, who's not labelled with Asperger's or autism. You know, he has a little habit for determining whether a day is going to be an unlucky day or a lucky day. You know, I know someone who does that. He has a habit of disliking foods that are yellow or brown. I know someone else who's like that. And someone else who can't eat foods if different food types are actually touching on their plate. And all of these people are, you know, quote, normal, unquote, people. But it's only when we put these things together that I find that I've got a portrait of a person that we call disabled.
Do you know somebody who can't comprehend jokes? Because they take everything literally, yeah.
I know a few of those people, and I certainly know a few people. And I, to be honest, most of these people tend to be either scientific or academic people, people who can't really do conversation with others, people who find it very hard to listen to what the other person is saying to them because they're so worried about what they're going to say next that they're concentrating on that.
My guest is Mark Haddon, author of the new novel, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Mark Haddon, is the author of the new novel, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. It's told from the point of view of a 15-year-old boy who has a type of high-functioning autism. Now, I've read that you worked with people who had autism. Is that right?
That's true. After university, I spent a few years working with both children and adults with a variety of physical and mental handicaps. Even at the time, autism was a fairly kind of loose and conjectural diagnosis. And it's only now looking back that I realized that some of those people were autistic. Although I have to say, all of them were much more severely disabled than Christopher is.
What was your job?
I had a variety of jobs. My first job when I left university was to work as a live-in volunteer with a young man who was crippled with multiple sclerosis. And he needed constant attention, we two of us lived in his house and did 24 hours on, 24 hours off, looking after him. And from then, I moved down to London and did a series of part-time jobs, helping with kids and adults, both in training centres and at home in their families.
What got you into that work?
What got me into that work was spending 3 years at Oxford University and feeling that I'd kind of eaten too much birthday cake, and I needed some kind of compensation to set myself right again. I'd had 3 years of you know, hard work, but in a fairly luxurious setting in which you know, if you're a student at a prestigious university, you're kind of the center of attention and you think you're pretty important. It was really nice to go out there and do what I thought of at the time as a proper job in which I was helping other people for a change. And I really felt it restored some kind of inner balance to my life.
I'm thinking that you might have learned a lot of things about yourself by working with people with disabilities, because since some of those disabilities were cognitive, you might have had to change things about yourself in order to communicate to them in a non-threatening way.
Funnily enough, I think I've learned more about myself by being a writer. I mean, the nice thing about working with people with disabilities is that you don't think about yourself. You know, you have to be patient, and you have to think about someone else all the time.
No, but that requires thinking about yourself, particularly if you're not patient. You know, that would be like an immediate diagnosis there. I am not patient, therefore I have to learn how to be patient.
Well, I can be quite a patient person, so I quite enjoy doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the time when I've really started to learn about myself is the hours on end you have to spend as a writer just thinking quietly in a room on your own. And I think actually for many people that would be a harder thing than working with people with disabilities, being in your own company that much.
You know, the story is written from Christopher's point of view, but reading it you can't help wonder about how difficult it must be for Christopher's parents, because there's such a burden on them to make the world manageable for him and to give so much of their time to creating a manageable world for him. And the parents aren't getting along. They're having problems themselves. Some of those problems are because of differences in opinion about how to deal with Christopher. So even though Christopher has no empathy, as a reader, you have to start thinking about what it must be like to be one of his parents.
That's true. And although I said earlier there will be no right depiction of someone with Asperger's, because people with Asperger's are a huge and varied group, having met a lot of parents of kids with disabilities, I think there is a kind of general picture of what happens in many, many families who have a child like Christopher. And as I said to someone recently, it's probably very similar to having a child who's special in other ways as well, a child who's peculiarly gifted. Again, I've seen parents, seen families where one parent, and it's usually the mother, devotes their life to looking after this child, and that child becomes their life project, and the other parent feels pushed to one side, and as if they have no role. And I've seen many, many families break up for precisely that reason. It causes other problems as well, in that as the child grows older and wants to become adult, you find that the parent who's given their life to looking after them has a vested interest in them staying as a child, and that causes huge difficulties.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Haddon. His new novel is called The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Mark, do you have a dog?
No, I don't. I have one cat, and that's all.
No, because I was thinking that the idea of a dead animal might be particularly upsetting to you.
It does, and in fact, I am a vegetarian, and on the whole, I'm very kind to animals. But I have a rather sort of dark English sense of humour, and when I wrote that first page with the dog impaled on the fork, I found it quite funny. But I found it quite funny only if I described in this flat, emotionless, toneless voice, which I really liked, and which over the next few pages became Christopher's voice.
What did you like about that flat, toneless voice?
What I like about it is perhaps best explained by saying, if you hear a really good comedian is funny because they don't laugh at their own jokes. And the converse is true as well. If someone's telling a very sad story, it's somehow sadder and more moving if they're not moved by it. That stops it becoming sentimental. And that's what I really liked about Christopher's voice. It's both funny because he doesn't seem to understand why it's funny, and it's more moving because he doesn't really understand why things are sad that are happening around him. And that stops the whole thing becoming sentimental.
Why don't you read that opening paragraph that Christopher narrates about the dog?
It was 7 minutes after midnight. The dog was lying on the grass in the middle of the lawn in front of Mrs. Shear's house. Its eyes were closed. It looked as if it was running on its side, the way dogs run when they think they are chasing a cat in a dream. But the dog was not running or asleep. The dog was dead. There was a garden fork sticking out of the dog. The points of the fork must have gone all the way through the dog and into the ground, because the fork had not fallen over. I decided that the dog was probably killed with the fork, because I could not see any other wounds in the dog, and I do not think you would stick a garden fork into a dog after it had died for some other reason, like cancer, for example, or a road accident, but I could not be certain about this.
Yeah, a part of his mind seems to be like your forensics mind, and the other part seems to be just kind of loopy and not really very intuitive at all. I guess that leads me to think, like, how do you size up a mysterious and shocking situation when you see it? Where do you look for clues, and what do you make of it? And he's both approaching it in a very logical forensics kind of way. He's also thinking strange thoughts like, I don't think you would stick a garden fork into a dog after it died for some other reason, like cancer or a road accident. I mean, that's true. That's kind of inarguable, but it's a kind of strange thing to be thinking.
It's a very strange thing to be thinking, and I think that's why I found the voice so funny. Although I have to say that this seems to be another aspect of Christopher's voice, because he doesn't try to push the reader one way or the other, trying to make them feel this or that about what he's said or what he's seen. Some people have read the book and wept their whole way through it and found the whole thing sad and the ending sad. And other people I've talked to have found it very funny the whole way through. So that people have completely different reactions to the same book.
Mark Haddon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mark Haddon is the author of the new novel, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Greg Osby's new CD, St. Louis Shoes. This is Fresh Air. A few years ago, composer and saxophonist Greg Osby began playing some soul jazz tunes of the 1950s and 60s to connect with a broader audience. Starting with familiar material makes it easier for some jazz fans to follow his improvising. On Osby's new CD, he covers tunes from the 19-teens to the 1980s by composers from W.C. Handy to Cassandra Wilson. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Bassist Robert Hurst on Greg Osby's version of East St. Louis Toad Low, which Duke Ellington recorded in 1926. Osby's quintet plays it kind of straight until they get to a new section, which pushes it into the present. The new bit launches from Duke's oompah rhythm, but places tricky, shifting accents over the top. Hopping between the beats, Osby ties James Brown's jittery funk to Anthony Braxton's Cubist zigzags. Greg Osby on alto saxophone with hot New Orleans trumpeter Nicholas Payton from Osby's new CD, St. Louis Shoes. For company, he's turned to players who move in more orthodox circles than he does, like Nicholas Payton and bassist Bob Hurst, who's recorded with three Marcellus's as well as Osby's old Brooklyn crowd. Even so, Osby subjects most of the vintage material to postmodern tweaking. He'll add extra beats or phrases to a melody, not to remake it for all time, but to put his own stamp on it. This is his revamp of Thelonious Monk's Light Blue. That's Osby's 21-year-old find, Harold O'Neill, on piano. The drummer is Rodney Green. Another reason Osby retools jazz standards like Summertime or Shaw Nuff is to keep the players off balance and on their toes. The payoff is in the playing. Nicholas Payton's trumpet solo on St. Louis Blues starts with a familiar lick he keeps chipping away at. Nicholas Payton. Greg Osby holds his own in such fast company with his clean saxophone tone, clear ideas, and slippery rhythms. He's a thinking person's jazz musician who can complicate the blues and get away with it. Most of Greg Osby's new album a lot, but for all his strengths, he rarely breaks my heart with a ballad, and two of them here lag a little. There is something of the cool customer about him, but it's not such a big deal, and the invited players bring heat to match his bright light. Together, they make these oldies walk and talk.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed St. Louis Shoes, the new CD by saxophonist Greg Osby. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Toms of Maine, maker of natural care products and creator of the Rivers Awareness Program to preserve the nation's waterways. Information at participating stores or tomsofmaine.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The film Gangs of New York comes out on DVD and video next week. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with director Martin Scorsese. And we hear from one of Scorsese's former collaborators, Paul Schrader. His latest film, Autofocus, is also out on DVD and soon will be out on video. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.